But the district still isn't giving the public the actual scores. Jim Roberts, who heads a local inspection program, began posting the documents in June.
I think, people oftentimes just want to know if the place is inspected and also where does it stand. And it's either in good standing or it needs to be reinspected or it's been suspended or inactivated.
Roberts says the move is meant to be an interim solution until the health department begins posting full inspection reports online, though no date has been set to start doing so. The department has been discussing how to post reports since first being questioned about it 4 years ago by student reporters. So while diners can review the status of the restaurant's health permit, they still won't see the scores. Instead, health permits labeled reinspection required are given to restaurants that score below 36 points, a failing score. But the district does not tell you what that means. Meanwhile, the status of health permits of restaurants that were closed due to scores below zero are labeled suspended. Roberts hopes to get feedback on this move as officials continue studying how to best publicize restaurant inspection scores.
It was always my thought and intention to put the full inspection report on there, and perhaps maybe that's on the website, for example. Maybe that's what people don't want. Maybe they would think this is enough information provided. This is what they were looking for, that they are inspected, and this is the standing of their health permit status.
Though it is common elsewhere, Champaign County does not require restaurants or other food retail facilities to post notices or placards of any inspection result. Other communities that have begun placard programs have seen results. Take Los Angeles County in California. Health officials there began requiring restaurant owners to post a placard with results in the late 1990s. That was also when the health department began posting inspection results online and introduced a new corresponding letter grade system. Angelo Bellomo is the director of L.A. County's Environmental Health Department. He says only 60% of restaurants in the area scored high on inspections before the new system was adopted. Now, he says, at least 85% of the restaurants score 90 points or higher.
Public knowledge affects public behavior, and restaurant operators have actually noticed fluctuations in the extent to which patrons will visit their facilities based on the letter grading.
Los Angeles County's scoring system is based on a 100-point scale with points deducted for violations. It's not unlike Champaign County's system. The big difference, however, is what the scores mean. Two consecutive scores below 70 in Los Angeles County could trigger a review of the restaurant's health permit or a 14-day closure. In Champaign County, scores below 36 trigger a reinspection, and if below zero, automatic closure. There are no federal standards on scoring, hence the lack of uniformity. Jeff Lineberry is executive director of the Conference for Food Protection, an advisory group made up of health inspectors and restaurant owners. He says scoring systems nationwide range from a number score to letter grades, like A, B, and C, to even color codes such as red, green, and blue.
Nevertheless, I think the trend is for more transparency. The public is certainly demanding it.
The debate is and has been how to best convey the information from a report that is a snapshot in time. Lineberry says anything can change between inspections. He says looking at inspection results over time is a better indicator. Jim Roberts in Champaign County said he'd like to have a joint study session with both local health departments on this very issue.
So I think by having more information, I think you could be a more informed diner and make a better decision.
And once again, Champaign County diners are left wondering when officials will stop studying how other municipalities successfully publicize restaurant inspections and will start doing it themselves. For Illinois Public Media, I'm Pam Dempsey.
To review restaurant reports, visit cu-citizenaccess.org. For the first time ever, one of the two major political parties in the country adopted a platform that embraces gay marriage. At the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, Tony Arnold found two Illinois delegates who say the issue isn't just political, it's personal.
Lauren Verdict often gets wistful when she talks about how she met her partner of 16 years, Gail Moores.
I catered her 40th birthday party, but I told her I owed her a birthday drink because I really didn't want to mix business with going out with her, but I thought she was very cute.
The two now live together on Chicago's north side. I met the two at a hotel restaurant in Charlotte, where they're both delegates for President Barack Obama. And they were on hand when the Democrats approved a party platform that included gay marriage.
This is fundamental. It's our lives. If we don't stand up for us, who is?
Morris is glad President Obama is now standing up for them, but she was starting to get impatient.
I was advocating for him to do it, to just come out and say, yes, I support it. The way he did, slowly evolving, rolling it out, having it come out at an appropriate time, was a much better teaching moment and a much better way to bring more people along with him.
Regardless of the national debate over gay marriage, Morse and Verdick have a personal interest in what happens in Illinois. A lawsuit is currently pending that seeks to end the state's gay marriage ban, but several state lawmakers, mostly Republicans, filed briefs supporting the current ban on gay marriage. Morse and Verdick did enter into a civil union when that became legal a little over a year ago.
It was very validating. But when it comes time in April for you to file your taxes, it doesn't mean a thing.
This is going to sound really stupid, but if Illinois does pass gay marriage, would you be married? Would you get married?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know her very well.
Would you marry me, Lauren?
I will marry you, Gail.
Now that Morris has popped the question, they just have to wait to see what Illinois' answer will be. From Charlotte, I'm Tony Arnold.
Gail Morris and Lauren Verdick aren't the only close partners in Charlotte. In the same hotel, Alex Keefe found another woman who has forged an artistic bond with several prominent Democrats.
Over the years, Chicago has become infamous for producing politicians who can be bought and sold. And that's what drew me to Elizabeth McClancy, who was camped out the other day in the lobby of the Illinois delegation's hotel.
Rahm Emanuel is for sale.
Rahm Emanuel is for sale.
And what does he cost?
Well, maybe 20. I don't know. Sure. Yeah, for Rahm.
That's $20,000. But let's be clear. McClancy is talking about a painting. She actually has an entire series of them, all of prominent Democrats like Emanuel.
Senator Kerry, President Carter, Senator Mikulski.
McClancy lives in North Carolina, so she was pretty excited when the DNC came to Charlotte just a few hours away. She's been doing these Democratic portraits since 2006, and there are 23 in all, including one she'd just as soon forget.
The 23rd one is John Edwards.
She starts to explain how the paintings capture Democratic leaders who embody the party's core ideals on certain issues.
It's more of a trying to find, finding snapshots. There's Governor Dukakis. Hello, Governor Dukakis!
McClancy sounds like a DNC groupie as she spots former presidential candidate Michael Dukakis in the hotel lobby. But believe it or not, McClancy says she used to be a diehard Reagan Republican. But now, she proudly holds the portrait of Emanuel in her lap. The mayor's bigger than in real life, with his chin resting on one hand and little flecks of royal blue in his eyes.
Thinking, considering, but thinking with, and I think that his eyes show this, thinking with a very well-informed perspective.
Earlier, she actually buttonholed the mayor before a press conference, portrait in hand, to get his verdict.
And he said, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And you said that about five times.
It might not be $20,000, but for McClancy, that just may have been worth the trip to Charlotte. At the Democratic National Convention in North Carolina, I'm Alex Keefe.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Global Commodity Analytics, Lafayette, Woodyard Allen Farms, Ridge Farm, Atlas Travel, Decatur, and Thorpe Farms, Gibson City. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
A long, long time ago.
One record, a father's name printed on the cover, a father who left and a daughter who remembers.
Kind of became a conversation between me and my dad, or a memory that never really happened.
The finale of our series, Mom and Dad's Record Collection, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
So bye-bye. Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 7th of September, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Edith Sitwell, born Scarborough, England, 1887. Her parents, Sir George and Lady Ida, baffled by their daughter. The mother was a great beauty, the daughter was not. She was rather tall and thin, with a curved spine and a hooked nose. Her parents forced her to wear an iron brace on her back, a contraption on her nose, in an attempt to make her more attractive. She was a bright and curious little girl, but her father was opposed to formal education for women. He thought it made them less womanly, so he wouldn't let her go to school. And she left her family on bad terms, Edith Sitwell, who went ahead to make her own life as a modernist poet and a public personality in Britain. She wrote many books of poems and put herself forward as a colorful personality. She wore enormous rings, turbans, old-fashioned gowns. She was a friend of Eliot and Graham Greene. She championed Dylan Thomas's poetry. She was a friend of Marilyn Monroe. And her best-known work was Facade, a series of poems set to music by Sir William Walton. The first London performance of Facade did not go so well. There was an old woman in the audience who waited outside afterwards, hoping to hit Sitwell with an umbrella. Noel Coward walked out on it. Virginia Woolf didn't much care for it. Edith Sitwell said, "I am an unpopular electric eel in a pool of catfish." It's the birthday of Jill Klein, born in Queens, 1946, author of Primary Colors, the novel based on Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign. And it's the birthday of writer Margaret Landon, born in Somers, Wisconsin, 1903. When she was 23, she and her husband went off to be missionaries in Thailand. She ran a school there. She raised her three children. And while she was there, she came across a book by a woman named Anna Leon Owens, a Welsh governess who had tutored the King of Siam's many wives and children back in the 1860s. Margaret Landon wrote a novel based on it called Anna and the King of Siam, which was a bestseller and became the basis for the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical The King and I. Here's a poem for today by Natasha Trethewey, Theories of Time and Space. You can get there from here, though there's no going home. Everywhere you go will be somewhere you've never been. Try this. Head south on Mississippi 49, one by one mile markers ticking off another minute of your life. Follow this to its natural conclusion. Dead end at the coast, the pier at Gulfport, where riggings of shrimp boats are loose stitches in a sky threatening rain. Cross over the man-made beach, 26 miles of sand dumped on the mangrove swamp, buried terrain of the past. Bring only what you must carry, tome of memory, its random blank pages. On the dock where you board the boat for Ship Island, someone will take your picture. The photograph, who you were, will be waiting when you return. Theories of Time and Space, a poem by Natasha Trethewey, from